Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there, this is Kevin Lindsay, and welcome to Systems and Cybernetics. I'm back after a short break, during which I spent time demolishing a system that was the inside of my house. Fingers crossed, no unintended consequences will manifest in the future, but I'm not so sure of that. Today, I am really excited to be in conversation with my guest, Carol Samford, about her latest book, Indirect Work, A Regenerative Change Theory for Business, Communities, Institutions, and Humans. Carol is a best-selling award-winning author, business educator, and designer of membership communities. Her books are required reading in multiple departments from Stanford here on the West Coast to Harvard on the East. For 40 years, she's collaborated with leaders to develop people and businesses to express their singular capabilities. Carol's clients include companies like Colgate, DuPont, and Seventh Generation. And Google's Innovation Lab uses her responsible business framework. Carol's own podcast, Second Opinion on Business Practice, is awesome and can be found on her website, carolsamford.com, or iTunes and Google Play. Welcome, Carol, to Systems and Cybernetics. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, you're welcome, Kevin. Thank you for inviting me. Looking forward.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to this conversation too. And I'd love to start by having you talk a little bit about your background and your relationship with systems and systems thinking. Can we start there?
Sure, we can start there. All right, so let's just start in college then, because that's where I really connected first. Two different paths there. I was couldn't quite figure out what to major in. I ended up with two majors and a minor by the time I left Berkeley. But one of the things that really changed the course of my life was we had a guy teaching there you may have heard of, Thomas Kuhn. He wrote The Structure of the Scientific Revolution. He was a visiting scholar, I think. And I sat in his class and I learned for the first time that truth moved. It was not constant, and that he had just published his book. And learning the idea that there was something called paradigms was my, I think, first introduction to systems, that they become so cohesive that we can't actually see what's forming and shaping them. So that had a huge influence, particularly a question one of us asked at the Rathskeller at the end of a day about how in the world did you help other people see this and change their mind? And he said, very clearly, well, I came up with the idea, that's your job now, to go work on that. So I took that so seriously that by the time I was 27, I created a framework for understanding systems in paradigm language and way to understand what the cohesiveness was. I also got to, in my introductory physics class, study with Edward Teller, who is one of the architects of hydrogen bomb and then was involved in atom bomb. But in our class, it was a huge auditorium. We had many people who had been students of David Bohm when he was there and worked on his doctorate. And they always came to sit in with Teller. And so I got to one of my TAs joined, or in, I'm not sure, well, I've forgotten all the details, but he had been connected to Bohm. So I got to be a part of a group that studied about it. So click forward, probably, the first big introduction to living system thinking, which is not all system thinking is alike. And I published an article in the late 90s at Wharton School on the four or five different kinds of system thinking and how people were getting trapped in the machine version of it that was coming out of MIT and Jay Forrester. And I've written many evolutions of that. So living system thinking, I got from my grandfather. So I have to go back in time a bit, who's part Mohawk. He always says I have to put in the part because I'm very proud of it, but I don't have the blood quantum to be Mohawk. But he was amazing in his engagements with me as a child. He worked for the what they call them, the people who help farmers, the Farm Bureau. And they help people learn how to work with soil and agriculture and the Agriculture Extension Service. And he would take me with him out to take care of pigs and the farm and the market, always talking to me about how those things work. Not as he wasn't educating me about what he thought, but asking me all the time, how did I think a market worked? Why did people come to a market? What have to do with their lives? And he would do the same thing with pigs. He'd let them out of the pen after we went down and put the slop right in the troughs and stuff. And they would follow us down to a creek, right? We'd all sit down by, and just like the pigs were our friend. And it was a very good way to work learn about how life worked. I had complications in my parenting structure, but I had so much help with my grandfather. So when I met a group of folks who had been applying all those kind of things into the business world, when I was 33 years old, I'm about to be 80, as you could tell, I'm an old lady. But I could see at 33 how this community, which had founded the first real systems work at Procter & Gamble in the early 60s, and I met them the end of the 70s, was making sense of how the world worked and how trying to help business. And even A.L. Laffley, who was CEO of P&G for years, said this was a turning point for P&G. So I got embedded with that group of people and eventually created my own communities of people who we come together many, many times a year, 8 weekends a year plus a bunch of other stuff working on, because I don't think this is something you take a course and then you're done. At least in my case, I'm still learning about it. So maybe that gives you a taste for.
Yeah, it does. And I'm just going to warn you and the listeners, I have a dog that tends to snore, and normally he's quiet, and he's more quiet if he's in the room with me. On this occasion, he might not be. So that might be the sound. It's not my stomach growling. I did have breakfast this morning.
It's not either of us snoring.
Exactly. I haven't put you to sleep. You haven't put me to sleep. It's Finnegan over there. So I want to share that, you know, my first exposure to your work was your 2020 book, The Regenerative Life, which I really encourage listeners to check out as well. We're not talking about that one today. We're talking about your newest book. And I mentioned to you in our prior conversation that I am drawn to work that starts to bring a lot of the systems theory, the models that we've talked a lot about on this channel previously and with different authors, to really bring those things to life. And by that I mean, you know, at the human level, at the level of the individual, as well as as human organizations, communities, businesses, and so on. I find that really interesting. And so, you know, when I read this book, it definitely struck me that, hey, this book is right up my alley, and you'd be an ideal person for a conversation here on systems and cybernetics. Early in the book, you write that in their efforts to do good, people are unintentionally keeping in place the very infrastructures, mental and physical, they would like to transform. And I guess that's kind of where I'd like to start this conversation, as a way to launch into indirect work and really hear from you what it is and how can it facilitate systems level change.
Let me give a little background on what I mean by do good, because I consider my primary audience people who are well-intended and who are seeking to really be changed. But it's a paradigm that's wrapped up in the idea that one group knows what is right and create a set of ideals. It's the same foundation as when we do colonizing. So when the Europeans came here and colonized this country, they thought they were doing a favor for all the native peoples who lived here, including taking their children away from them and putting them in schools and not allowing speaking of their native language. So it depends on whose definition of good. And I find well-intended people all wrapped up in missions and visions. And if you just listen to that, it says how anthropocentric that idea is, that we as a group have worked on ourselves. We've studied things. We know how life works. And we're going to tell you what the ideals are. Now, Einstein offered that idea, which is really what I'm speaking to in that quote that you talked about, where well-intended people end up undermining their own intentions. Einstein said in 27 places, don't use the mind that created the problem to try and create the new path into the new era. I'm sure you've read that almost every author, speaker, people who explore this kind of stuff quote that. Now, I happen to have a little bit of an insight on what it meant, because the students I was with at Berkeley, including Edward Teller, studied with Einstein when he was teaching at Princeton, and they asked the question about what he meant by that. Now, here's a shorthand version. He said, if you look at Newtonian physics, what's really metaphorically at work there is Newton was thinking like a billiard ball player. Now, I'm saying what he said, but I think he meant a pool table, because he described where someone decides what the pockets are that everyone should be in, and then they look and see who the cue balls, the people who need to be moved in those pockets are. And they think that they are the cue stick and they can maneuver it to get those people into the pockets, which means they are acting as though they know the answers. Now, you can see that's related to my do good paradigm. Thank you, Thomas Kuhn, for helping me think about that. He said, what we've learned in quantum physics is that the Newtonian model actually is only used to us really in the physical world, not in physical phenomena. What we have to do is learn to think in a matrix mode. Now, think about what a matrix means. And he used the idea of a woman being pregnant, and the matrix is literally the womb. You don't get to decide for that fetus, whether it's a gorilla or a human or whatever mammal, you don't get to decide what it becomes. You can't do anything except try and keep the matrix healthy. You have to learn what it is that being growing needs to draw on. And so he said, us learning that our work is And he even was working with Heisenberg at that point. And he said, we've learned that most of the time when we try and move something, it actually ricochets. We can't even on the pool table, if we try and move humans around, know we've got the right pockets, that if we hit them, they're going to go where we want on our billiard table / pool table. And more importantly, that the cue stick actually has an ability to determine velocity or direction or outcome. Because we know that often many things move at one time. He said our major work now is to learn to understand how things are working, not how we can maneuver them and manipulate them. So now let me translate that, if you would, to what my quote means that you cited. What I see is, and I say this to all the people who are in my communities with their corporate leadership groups or their change agents in a different community, that the moment we get into proscribing and creating ideals and projecting those and teaching them and putting them into missions, we have defined ourselves as a cue stick, not as a nurturer of a womb, and not as the entity that has to learn first to be receptive to what the fetus is doing and to ask what our role is, not to define the fetus and its eventual outcome, and not to therefore try and intervene in its growth or its direction, but move into being nurturers of the matrix. So what I meant is, right now, every well-intended initiative I see, from climate change to racism to pandemic management to inequality, all are based on somebody knows the answer and we're going to convince the other people and we'll vote the ones who don't see this out of office and we'll maybe do some demonstrations and convince them. It's all about manipulating from good intentions rather than asking what it takes to have a healthy matrix. Did that translate?
It did. And I really resonated with that when I read it in the book. And, you know, just I wrote down your quote, we are not on earth to knock things around, in, you know, in reference to that billiard ball metaphor. I just, wow. I mean, that was just one of those takeaways for me. So I really appreciate that. In the book, you provide what you call intermezzos. And we talked a little bit about these because you really encourage the reader to be diligent about doing them. And, you know, after every chapter, do some work, right? And I commented that I did some, you know, some I put aside for later. But these are really opportunities to reflect and put into practice what the reader has been learning. And I love them. How would you describe them?
They are to do zero work on incorporating what you learned. That's a humanist theory. And that's why I wanted to know whether you read them. You missed the point, Kevin. So let me tell you the point. Yes, you very much missed it. And so you don't feel too bad, 60% of the people, it looks like, miss it. Now, the reason is you're conditioned to learn from smart people. And you're putting me in a class of smart people, right? So you want to be able to incorporate what I know. Book number 7 is called No More Gold Stars. And the reason it's called that is I'm trying to stop people from absorbing others' ideas, from borrowing others. The whole point of the intermezzo, and I want you, if you would allow me to give you an instruction, to go back and reread the introduction to the intermezzo. It says, watch your own mind. Watch how easy it is for you to try and learn what I know, not question, not challenge, not form your own thoughts, not disagree, but we are conditioned by behaviorist theory for the last 100 years to absorb and borrow. This is the key word, borrow other people's ideas unexamined. So I was asking for the intermezzos for you to reject initially everything I say. And notice how your mind will not let you when you've decided I am I've got some answers. You now want those answers. And my point is to try and keep you. Now, a few people, I had pre-readers. I had 160 people who pre-read this book so I could find out what they did with it. And those that did manage to get the point, like, be really careful. Don't make notes about what I said and what you're going to do with it. Instead, watch your own mind. Question your own mind. Watch how lazy it is. Watch how much it wants to adopt. And then most exercises are given to people to incorporate the learner's ideas. I was trying to stop you from incorporating the writer's ideas. And so each chapter was more and more disruptive. And most people quit doing them because they thought, well, I'll come back. I'm going to get through everything. The minute you skip the intermezzo, you're doing my worst nightmare, right? You're now getting through it. And sometimes, so that's
well,
why
I was guilty of that. I was guilty of that a little bit. Now, I did work the Intermezzo 2, which really focused on levels of worldview. I love that one. And so maybe I didn't do what you wanted me to do there, but I just kind of immediately loved it and started applying it and thinking about it in my work. So I found it extremely useful.
Of course, but useful for this. Yeah, useful for a different purpose, which was, here's some things I can use. Until you examine them with your own life, and I say to all my students, I teach in universities, and I say, don't trust me. Under any condition, don't trust me. And I give you these two principles. Don't reject anything I say without deeply embedding it in your experience, and the intermezzos were intended to be experienced, or don't accept them. Because if you do that, you are now a guinea pig in the maze, and you're not building your capacity to think for yourself. So book number 7, because I watch so many people do what you're describing, and it sounds like you worked at it a bit, so you, I have hope for you. I want people to realize the major problem we have with everything from climate change to racism is because people do not think for themselves. The behaviorists conditioned us to believe, sorry, I'm now working on book 7, but it's relevant to the intermezzo. We are now in a behavioral era for the last 100 years, which was built on the five foundations, but let's do two which relate to your question. One is humans have no inner process. They have no consciousness, no soul, and therefore they can't think for themselves. Secondly, you need experts, which were formed out of the behaviorist era, who will do the thinking for you. And you only want to trust experts who, number 3, are using, quote, science. And they're using, of course, positivist science, which is fragmented and brings nothing alive anymore, but down into pieces. And every profession we have, every primary institution is based on behaviorism's ideas, and the expert model is what I was trying to destroy with the intermezzo and say, figure out some things for yourself by watching what I'm writing. But I wanted it at 2 levels, so you could have something to test, and I do my community meetings the same way. I write in semantic language when I'm with people. And semantic language, named at least by Alfred Korzybski, said that we need to write in a way people can't get what we mean in the first, second, or third reading. But they get intrigued because what we're doing is evoking images. Semantic language evokes images. And so you have to sort through and understand what it means, not have objective language where you think you know all the words and don't think. So the intermezzo is all about disrupting that behavioral idea that you can't think for yourself.
Yeah, I thank you so much for that. And, you know, Going through this book, it's not a very long book. It's
140 pages. Right.
So one might think, oh, this is a fairly quick read. But I did realize fairly early on, this is a workbook. You know, plan to spend a significant amount of time with this thing. And, you know, you might need to set it aside, come back to it, and engage with the work repeatedly or, you know. So, yeah, I thank you for that. And
including the lecture.
Yes, I really appreciate that. I do want to go back to a couple of things that you said, actually. And you referred to David Bohm and, you know, kind of what you learned from that school. And so the chapter called A Theory of Change was really meaty. I liked it, and I like how you create, this model or this theory that brings indirect work into like how you've evolved some of that thinking, kind of based on some of those, that early education that you had. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
About the, tetrad I did around the way.
Yeah. All
right. Okay. I work with something called frameworks, not models. And that's an incredibly important distinction because models are always guides to building the paper airplane, right? You have a template. It gives you the answers, which is what the behaviorists told us. Go get the answers from the experts. Frameworks give you a basis for questions based on how living systems work. They have no answers in them. They're like the space in which you are invited to think. So the way I put together this book, again, since I'm working on getting people to think for themselves, was a framework. And there, we can't talk about all of it, but let's talk about a couple of things. One of the things that David Bohm talks about, we can see the world on different levels. Same thing Thomas Kuhn was saying, same thing Einstein, same thing Sri Aurobindo and the mother, same thing Socrates. I read in a particular band across many, many different wisdom teachers. I'm mostly not interested in things which aren't at least tested for 100 years. Pop psychology is all based on machines and behaviorism, and you know, I stay away from it. But the core that runs through all of them, and Bohm does a really good job of describing it, is this idea of worlds. And he calls it three worlds. One is the explicate world, the world that's in existence that we can touch and see, and it can't be changed much unless you destroy it, make it back into powder and atoms and rebuild it. But if we go to the implicate world is where we take direction from in this tetrad I gave you. And the implicate world is everything from our thinking to our impressions that have not manifest yet. So if I'm thinking about a meeting I want to run, if I'm conscious, if I'm awake, all the planning and thinking I'm doing, if I'm not borrowing something I've already done, is implicate. It's implied that that's going to happen. Bohm said, that level is where we need to be working to see systems at work. At the level of explicate, you can't see a system at work because everything's dead. It's not moving. This machine, this house, this field. And so we have to learn to move up to an implicate order. And I won't go, the top one is supra implicate in Bohm's work, which is that which is forming and shaping all that is becoming implicate. You know, it's a much longer conversation we can have. But just get the idea of learning to work with implicate, which the behaviorists said don't exist. They said nothing exists except what an instrument of an expert in an expert's hands can see. So this book is about talking about learning, what does the implicate mean? And I said there are three ways I've learned to do that. And one of them is working on capability, because you think about the matrix. You want the womb, the matrix, to have the capability to deliver what it needs. And mostly the womb will take over, because even in concentration camps where women were starved, they produce healthy babies because the matrix will take what it needs. But it's better for all if we nurture the matrix. And so saying our role is to build the capability of the matrix, and that could be of a child growing up or a business coming in. You want the matrix to be healthy. Another word for that might also be the culture. And so that's the second thing I suggest as the way. And by the way, I use Phil Jackson in the, I love basketball and grew up loving it. Phil Jackson, who won 11 National Basketball Association championships, most in history, with the Chicago Bulls and the LA Lakers. He uses this method. He works on not beating his team up or yelling and or motivating. He does it indirectly, building capability, building culture, and building consciousness. So that matrix, that framework, doesn't have the what you do in there, but it said work on being a great builder in the matrix, as Einstein begged. Pay attention and develop the capacity, the implicate order, to do better thinking, better conceiving, better understanding, better state of being, and then do all the work indirectly. So I came to that by looking at how this shows up in all of what I call life development processes, where you don't go to a cave and meditate for 30 years and then you're done. You actually use life as a substrate for development. So that's why this book and all my first five books before that, and my courses, or not courses, but communities with parenting and educators and others, said, learn to do what Phil Jackson did. Work indirectly on building these capabilities. And I try and draw from Lakota elders. I had Mohawk elders, but Jackson had Lakota, from Socrates, all the great teachers who've said, in life is where you want to learn, not as a Buddhist monk or not as a monk. And so that's how that framework came together, was looking across these indigenous teachings, the lineage teachers, and the quantum teachers.
Wow. A couple of things. You might enjoy listening to my conversation with Jeremy Lent.
Like Jeremy.
Yeah, fantastic. His most recent book, Web of Meaning, was really up in that realm. It's fantastic. And I also wanted to say, I read this, during NBA finals. Like, it's now, I don't know when people will listen to this, but it's now the third week of June, and the Warriors won just last week, of course. So I was watching for that. I was watching for the Phil Jackson lessons.
Well, and of course, Steve Kerr is a protege and was on the Chicago Bulls. And he credits, of course, Phil Jackson for what he learned. And it's funny, I just decided to send him a copy of Indirect Work day before yesterday. So it will have landed in the Golden State Warriors offices in San Francisco. We'll see if he gets there or if he does anything with it. I sent him two so he could give Phil one.
Awesome. That is really great. So I want to unpack the triad. So you do talk about in your regenerative theory of change, one of the components is the way. And I think if I've understood this correctly, I can look at this approach as a technology of change, And the components, you know, being capability, culture, consciousness, I'd love to unpack that a little bit more. One of the pieces that kind of struck me in the capability chapter was some things that you were talking about around just kind of the way that we bring these capabilities. There was a conversation that I had with Ray Eisen on his book, The Hidden Power of Systems Thinking. And what I was struck with was, you know, there's a power to just employing systems thinking, but there's also this hidden power of systems that really can be mysterious and, you know, hard to identify. And when you talk about destructive infrastructures that prevent or restrict the development of human capacity, that really came to mind, that a lot of these things are, we don't get them. We fall into these traps or these blind spots. And so just in terms of your, you know, how you look at your capability framework and how it maybe can help us navigate the complexity of systems or these hidden systems, maybe. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
This is a huge question.
I'm famous for these gigantic questions.
Right. I'm thinking, given that you entered at the point of capability, let's start from there as a way to answer your, or first, I think of my offerings here. It can be used as technology, but I'm really inviting people to use them to check their own technology, their own method, their own way, and say, are we working indirectly? And one of the frameworks I provide is another one of those learn to think that things exist in different worlds. And I don't remember what I called it, but it's about using the right mind. I'm putting the right mind to work. And most of the time we do Einstein's thing like a billiard ball table, and we make things. So we make the world, I should say, into things, and it's all fragmented and chopped up. So if you want to be able to see systems, and not all systems are equal, not all system thinking, am I a fan of it all? I think there, some of them are named that, but even Jay Forrester said, please don't use my stuff on people. And of course, MIT and folks decided, well, you know, Jay can't control us or whatever they said to themselves. So they ended up doing a lot of things like feedback loops. And in my fourth book, No More Feedback, I talk about how the psychologists wanted to get in with the scientists in cybernetic systems, which your show's name comes off of. And so they converted so much into the thing world and the science that was used in the thing world. You can't see systems from things that are dead and not moving and not working as a living system. So, for example, you can go study a, quote, watershed, or you can be from the Department of Food and call it a food shed, or you're from Oceanographic, something you call it the airshed. All those are fragmentations. And if it's a watershed, you'll divide it up into a variety of things called rivers and soil. And then you can study that, and you can publish a report on the watershed system. I've seen many of them. And they are not anything about systems thinking. They're about things. And so the base level at which we keep looking and thinking we're studying system is a fragmented kind of way where we put things in boxes and create generic kinds of watersheds. I call it a life shed. Until you get to the idea of a life shed where all of those things are work together, and humans, non-human species, biota, and you're watching all that dynamic, you can't get to system thinking because you're in a thing world at the base level. The next level up is the process world. And the process world is where we decide to see as a flow. Okay, I think I'm seeing it a lot. It's alive because this happens and this happens, and this connects to that. There's this kind of relationship. And so we do all of this stuff in a way that we think we're looking at systems because it looks like a process, and a process is insufficient to what makes it alive, because you're not looking at it working, but at it as it as almost like a camera where you take snapshots and move through something. So again, you can't see the process as the process level, you can't see system. So I'm going to go to the fourth level mostly because I want to do a little more here, which is if you can begin to see holes, which is what David Bohm cautions about. Yeah, I suggest everyone here read Wholeness and the Implicate Order. The first, well, the second half of the book is all physics, which I had to read around because I can't do all the kind of math that's in there. But his core message, and it's in the title, is we have to stop fragmenting. Now, we have to quit seeing things at the level of things and the level of process and see it as a whole. And then the way to do that, and even when I tell you the way, you won't know how to do it because it's a big mind shift. It's like a quantum jump, literally, you know, Einstein's leap out, is learning to see the essence of a whole. So if you go, which I got to do, work with two major watersheds in British Columbia, and since you know the area, I'll use those. One of them is the Okanagan Valley on the east side, and it has an essence because of its founding, its geological patterns, its hydrological patterns, and hydrological begins to give you a feel of what it means to see something at work, right? If I say water, now we've got a thing. But if you talk about hydrology throughout ancient times, what we know about Earth, indigenous patterns, how First Nation people engaged there, brought economics and different cultures to it, we now can begin to see, and we did something, I didn't do it, I have colleagues who do this, called something called storying a place. So you do what the evolutionary unfolding story of a place is. And you can say, what's the essence? Now, I've forgotten the exact words we used, but it was something like I think we may have used self-serving, but we didn't mean it in the way we normally, we meant they almost unanimously up and down that valley refused to accept British Columbia's version of what healthcare should be. And they established their own system where people took care of people, including what we normally think as experts were merged into the living process. They weren't something that took care of people from the outside. They educated. It was like a whole different world of how people came together there. Now, I can understand the Okanagan Valley as a whole because I know its essence. And if you go out to Vancouver Island, you have, that island, if you look at its hydrological and geological story, is that, and I'm not a geologist, so I probably won't get this exactly right, that section did not break off from the continent. It floated up from Peru, right? And it became, over a millennia of time, a piece that was, as rocks and plates and things are moving around. And it had a different set of indigenous people. And we got to spend quite a bit of time with several of the elders. I got to take my grandson up. We did a storying of that place. And that place had a very different story. Now I worked with British Columbia to redefine their economic development based on the actual storying of the essence of that place. And people said it was so profound because we were able, instead of doing planning for fiber, fuel, or food, which all go in the same place, we can understand the system and not have battles in the, by the way, on my Vimeo channel, I have a video of the presentation to the what do they call them, deputy ministers and the minister of several different processes. Now, my point, so I don't wander off and get lost, is you can feel the difference of when you, if we had thought about British Columbia as a thing and we divided it up by provinces and disciplines and functions and so forth, we would, and there were people who were doing that. They were mapping, quote, mapping all of the resources, all of the thing area, nothing alive, it's this and this. We had other people who were doing process and saying, we have to build connections and relationship. And they built so many task forces to cross over. Nobody could get to all the meetings. That's what happened. Happens when you do process thinking. You try and relate things, see a flow, see a connection, put all the people who should be talking, but you can't, that's starting with a fragment and trying to put it together in a whole. Or you can do what David Bohm said, you have to have a way to understand wholes. And my work coming through many lineage traditions, including my grandfather's, I learned about wholes when I was very young. And I learned to see the world that way, and I couldn't understand when everybody kept talking about the fragments. So I, along with a series of other people, evolved and drew from all these traditions on how you see a whole. It's learning to do essence thinking. And I just did another podcast with Tyson Wright. And we talked about this, about what it means to learn to do this. And he said, well, tell people how you can do it. Said, you can't tell people how to do this. They have to be immersed for at least a dozen years in a culture that's working this way. And then one day they'll get their first hint and then their next. And pretty soon you won't be able to see the world any other way. So that's what that one on the end of that framework says the way. It has, you know, this triad of capability, culture, and consciousness. That's one of the examples I get of learning to work on capability to cathect. That's a psychological word. In other words, make myself think at a systems level, but at a living systems level, because can define systems at those lower levels too.
Yeah. And that sounds so much like something Tyson would say. So I kind of chuckled there for a moment. I think it was about a year ago, I had an opportunity to interview him on his book, Sand Talk, here on this channel.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Fantastic. And so thank you for that explanation and using, you know, a very real example, one that I, as you said, can connect with the British Columbia example. I definitely learned something there. But for me, it also really brought to life something that you said that in the book, that you wrote in the book, around discernment and revealing the essence of something. And then I'll quote you, you know, from the characteristic patterns in the roles that a living system will choose and the ways it goes about playing them. That, yeah, like, I think that you really helped me understand that with that example. That was great.
Let me give you a piece about, on that quote you just said. One of the things I try and help people understand is how the do-good model has created this old idea that every human should find their purpose. You know, there are at least a million coaches alive in one county who are teaching people how to find their purpose. I did one of my 5 TEDx talks on humans don't have purposes. They have roles. And if you're in a system, I mean, purpose is something the system has. It's working. If you take the 2 life sheds that I talked about in British Columbia, each of them have a purpose in a continent on a planet, all of which are alive. And if every human thinks they have a purpose, we get in a lot of trouble, because what they want to do is project what their ideals are, and then they feel so good, but you've just labeled someone and stamped on them, almost impossible to reverse, an anthropocentric of one human within a system. So I was trying to, in speaking in that little sentence, I think, although I wrote this book 3 years ago, so I've lost a little track. But I know that the whole idea of moving us, and it's an ego thing, right? Wait, what do you mean I don't have a purpose? Of course I do. I'm a human, right? No, you don't have a purpose. But if you can become receptive to that you are embedded in and nested in a living system, which you have a key role to play. And I have an opinion about what their role is, but I don't think the opinion is what matters. It's learning to really think about what is the role of humans and how can I be a part of helping that living system as a matrix create the health and vitality for life. So little bit more on that one little quote.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I know we're going to need to just wrap up here in a few minutes. But there's something that you, another comment that I've underlined in the book. You say that
I also tell people don't underline in my book. It's a bad practice. Go ahead. Read.
Well, I think we all have our ways and our bad habits, but I do it, and it has helped me here when I wanted to prepare for our conversation. Hey, so you say that we can't seem to rise above a transactional mindset, and you say that in the context of talking about, you know, the intersecting ecological catastrophes caused by centuries of value extraction. So that's obviously big, important topic. Are you hopeful that we can rise above a transactional mindset? Is your goal here to provide some insights and some help on that front?
No, absolutely not. That would be me being a cue stick and moving all the cue balls around into the pockets I think they should be in. What I'm working on, and I run a business summit every fall, which is one of the few open things I do. You have to be a member to be in most. And that one always takes on a subject. Like last year, we took on racism and looked at the premises. So I'm hopeful if we can work the way I'm about to describe, which is we worked on the premises that are social constructs that actually limit us from being able to see how things work. So, for example, racism exists because we think there's such a thing as race. There's no such thing. It's a social construct which leaves us a great opening to categorize and box people. And then to define whether or not people fit there, and if they don't, they're given a psychological diagnosis. You know, if it's mental health, it's ADHD or something. And so if we keep working on racism the way we are, we're escalating. Everyone can see it's getting worse. We are increasing the rate at which we harm people purely for the color of their skin or their words because they don't fit in our box. But we don't have any boxes. And if we can begin to see, I wrote an article called Essence is the Ultimate Diversity. And personal agency is the ultimate inclusion. So that means each essence finding a way to be in service of something. And we engage people from that place. Now I have hope that we stop. If we keep creating identities and I'm identified with my white race or my Hispanic race or whatever it is, anyone who doesn't fit goes in a different box. And so our premises are so flawed. And even for climate change, we have defined, and I listen to people and what they say are the solutions. And they don't know how to think nodally, which is what a premise is. It says, what is it that if we worked on it, it would make everything move? And it's the premises, it's the false social constructs. Like race exists, even like gender exists. It doesn't. We have some things that are due for procreation, but I don't know, the last form I had to fill out for gender had 8 options, you know, and of course some people are disturbing me past 2. I think all the extract value. And I worked in DuPont. I worked in mining. And people say, why do you go work in those horrible places? And I said, well, they aren't horrible people. They're living inside the social constructs. And you have a different one. And just fighting between yours and elections and demonstrations and railing and whatever we do will not help us. We have to learn to see the effect our constructs have. And we can't, in spite of Greta, what's her name, who I love, imploring us. Socrates said, the more we implore people and inspire them to go in a particular direction, the less likely they are to understand who they are and what they can do. And so Socrates said the sophists stand on a street corner and they motivate us, which she does, right? And they tell us great stories. And then we go away and shortly thereafter, we either forget or we try it and can't figure out how to do it. And because we go away inside of our social construct and their social construct, and we're never taught to really look at how it is we're forming the ideas. So we do Einstein's thing. We use the social construct we've got, and work on creating the new. So I think if we can help people understand that the consciousness of being able to see our own premises. And I do a lot of that within companies and other places. Go back and question your premises. And I use frameworks like the billiard ball table and the matrix and the levels. All of those are just instruments and all in the same work. We have work to do as humans. And we are incomplete when we're born in that capacity. And unless we can build the capacity to use what it means to be human in our role, I'll be long dead and, my grandchildren will be dealing with it. So that's an unpleasant thought. But I believe if we could pay attention. Many of the people you interview are working on some of the same things I'm working on. One of the uniquenesses that I have is I do have a technology for how to do it. It isn't a philosophy. It's a practice with details about how you work on yourself and groups and community. And in book 7, I'm going to do a lot more about the role of business because I'm now convinced only business can get us out of this. I'll leave you with that.
Thank you for that. Well, Carol, it's been such a pleasure to spend time with you, and thank you for sharing your wisdom. I know that you have a meeting with some people on the other side of the world that you need to get to, so I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for talking today with me.
Well, Kevin, thank you for inviting me. I've deeply enjoyed this conversation. I love what you're up to. So thanks for letting me be a part of it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. This is Kevin Lindsay, and you've been listening to my conversation with Carol Sanford. We've been talking about her book, Indirect Work, A Regenerative Change Theory for Business, Communities, Institutions, and Humans. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, so long.